I'm Jason Wright, and this is the Texas Titans Podcast, where I sit down with peak performers from all walks of life, looking for their secrets to success. I hope you enjoy the conversation here on the Texas Titans Podcast.
He just came in. I'll call you back.
Guess you're out here to open an IRA.
Fox, I'm Henry Patterson with the Postal Inspection Service. This is Mr. Ebenhopper from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Evan Morrissey from the Securities and Exchange Enforcement Office.
You're under arrest, Mr. Fox, for conspiracy to commit securities fraud and for violating the Insider Traders Sanction Act.
The minute I laid eyes on you, I knew you were no good.
You have the right to remain silent and refuse to answer questions. Do you understand? Anything you do say may be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police and to have an attorney present during any questioning now or in the future.
Oh, there it is. Bud Fox from Wall Street, one of the greatest films ever in the history of cinema, where Bud has finally realized that he's going down for all of his shenanigans, insider trading and whatnot with Gordon Gekko. It's a bad day for Bud. And you're going to be hearing from a guy who has had similar conversations with clients, or actually employees of clients, Mr. Steve Dawson. Steve is a forensic accountant. He's the guy that you go in, that goes in and looks for anything that's not exactly the way it should be. And you know, you think that forensic accounting, and so I start the conversation off with Steve, and I say that, it's like, you know, forensic accounting, that's not exactly a sexy topic for a podcast, but man, some of the crazy stories that he has for people thinking that they're going to get away with something, and that's one of the things that he said, is that they always think they're going to get away with it. It's really quite remarkable what people believe that no one will ever learn about them. And so it's a great conversation with some of the experiences he's had. But also, as always, I'm trying to bring you entrepreneurs that have built their businesses, and Steve is that guy. Steve Dawson is a CPA who has built an incredible business, and let me just tell you a little bit about him. For over 30 years, Dawson has performed forensic investigations and related forensic services for various businesses and agencies, representing industries ranging from federal and state governmental agencies to financial institutions to nonprofit organizations and to a multitude of mom-and-pop type industry organizations. He is a nationally recognized speaker in fraud detection, prevention, and internal control design methodologies. He is a graduate of Texas Tech University with a Bachelor's of Science degree in accounting and holds a certified public accountant certificate in Texas and a certificate as a certified fraud examiner. It's a good conversation, folks, with an entrepreneur in a unique field. And, you know, just listen to this conversation, and those of you out there who may be thinking that you're going to try to pull something over and not make your bones on the straight and narrow, well, maybe this conversation will make you take a second look. Folks, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for being here with me on the Texas Titans Podcast. Enjoy the show. Oh, and please consider going out and giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes. That would really, really mean the world to me. Thank you, folks. Man, I'm so glad you're here. And like we were talking a little bit in the warm-up, you know, forensic accounting, you know, may not sound like the most riveting of subjects, but I'm fascinated. And so I can't wait to not only get into some of the stories, especially as a business owner and a small business owner, which I've got to believe that you see cases where that I'm interested in digging into, such as internal fraud that happens to, say, a first, second generation business. They hire someone from the outside that comes in and almost uses the company as a piggy bank. I've heard of stories like that more than once, unfortunately. And so I'm looking forward to hearing about that and kind of the path that took you down this rather unique road of accounting, if you will. So this is going to be fun.
I think we're going to have a good time.
All right. Well, good deal. Well, first of all, let's just start with the basics.
how did this happen? Because I can't imagine that when you were a child and your kindergarten teacher, you know, asked the class, so what do you want to be when you grow up? You raised your hand and said, well, first I'm going to get my CPA license and I'm going to do accounting. Then I'm going to do forensic accounting. So what led you into this particular path of accounting?
Well, I always say that rather than me choosing forensic accounting, it actually chose me. I was in a CPA firm serving as a partner. And in the annual audits that we did, just the regular financial statement audits that we did, I worked in the financial institution arena. And that was one of my areas of specialty, banks, credit unions, things like that. So as a result of that, that seemed to be where fraud was. Wherever there was cash, wherever there was loans, there was fraud. And so I kind of accidentally started tripping into it quite a bit. And before I knew it, several years later, that's all I'm doing is the forensic work, doing any type of fraud work that showed up in our client base. And so that's how that started.
Okay. And then take me through some of those early cases. I mean, because fraud is just, it's a scary word, you know, and what it indicates to me is not only foul play, but intentional foul play. And so kind of take me through some of those early cases. And for the listener, especially a small business owner, kind of, you know, going back to what I was talking to earlier, if you're a small business owner, let's say you do a top line $1 to $2 million a year, which is, you know, by all accounts, a healthy business, but considered a small business, right?
Right.
That individual, if fraud is happening and it's undetected, man, that can be crippling to a company that size. So what were some of those early things that you saw that folks were doing?
Absolutely. It is crippling to an organization when something like that happens. And most of these organizations, these small businesses, they're not necessarily covered by insurance, fidelity insurance, or any type of employee dishonesty insurance. And so some of these cases, you know, just from a cash theft from the cash drawer to some of the loan frauds that we run into where fictitious loans are being made and then written off, these cause big dollar, big losses for organizations. But we've had so many in these small businesses early on. Some of those cases involved somebody just taking from the cash register. And, you know, it's all internal fraud. You know, we get into the situation where you're supposed to trust the people that work for you, but we're not supposed to have blind trust.
Right.
And so when we do have that internal trust with no real validation as far as the transactions that they're performing, then that turns into blind trust and it turns into a loss for an organization.
So one of the things I always like to figure out, Steve, is kind of tricks and habits and methodologies that are executed. And you are very good at one of the things I'm most horrible at, which is detail, you know, and kind of connecting dots. I'm not a detail oriented guy, you know. So what is your strategy when you go into a client to start, like what red flags are you looking for? And here's the thing too, that I would like to tease out just for the fun of it. I got to believe some of these people are better than others. So I would like to hear just a story of where just an absolute moron really thought they were getting away with something and they weren't. But then also kind of that case that you've dealt with where you're looking and you go, wow, this individual, if they were to put their mind to something constructive and positive, could really do some good work. Kind of take me through some of those deals.
Absolutely. Some of these fraud jobs, they think that nobody is going to ever catch them. Let's just take credit card use as an example, personal use of a company credit card. And the organization has very little internal controls. And so the individual uses the company credit card for personal purposes. And that type of situation is common. And the credit card statement is going to get looked at. And so I think you use the word moron there. Really, you have to think, how can you possibly think that this is not going to be caught?
Right.
And let me give you a perfect example of the mind of the perpetrator, the type of person that's doing this. We had a case one time where the individual was planning and reserving meeting rooms for conferences for their company. And so they would call the hotel and say, I'm going to have a conference with about 400 people. Will you please send me a quote? And so the hotel would send them a quote, and it would be, let's just say, $8,000.
Right.
Well, the actual conference was not going to be 400 people. There was a conference, but it was only going to be about 200 people. And so what this individual did was they took their quote to their employer and said, I paid for this with my personal credit card. Please reimburse me. And so the company reimbursed that individual $8,000. Then when the meeting actually took place, she paid for it with her personal credit card. Didn't have to turn in anything else. And so on that one transaction, she made $4,000.
Wow.
And that is an example of, it's not terribly creative, but I mean, the story gets better. So I call this person the genius because they did enough of this, or she did enough meeting room planning, conference planning for her organization that she could do this three times a week.
Oh,
so let's add the numbers up. You know, that's $12,000 a week.
And
that's pretty good take.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's how that fraud was caught. This individual also went to lunch 5 days a week. And anytime you go to lunch and pay for it with a credit card, you get two little slips. One's the merchant copy and one's the customer copy. And on the merchant copy, she would tip maybe $4 for the meal. And on the customer copy, she would write that up to $5, take it back to her employer, tell her employer, I paid for this business lunch, please reimburse me. The employer would reimburse her. And in that one instance, she would make one extra dollar. And that's how she got caught.
Really? Like
after that one extra dollar, when she actually was making $12,000 a month or a week.
That is insane.
It is. But that's the mind of what we're dealing with. You can be so creative, yet so moronic at the same time.
Right, right. All right. So tell me about a case where, you know, you hear these stories, and I've had them. I mean, as a small business owner, you know, early in life, you find yourself where you're just like, you're kind of at your wit's end going, how am I going to make it from one month to the next? Now, my business was real estate brokerages, so it's pretty clear cut. There's really not a lot you can do there. But have you come across instances where it is a family-owned business and you find either the principal of the company or even worse, maybe a second-generation member of the family who's on the take, or maybe either out of greed or desperation? And then how in the world do you handle that conversation?
Those are difficult conversations. We've had that exact situation numerous times. And one of the most tragic ones that I can recall was a situation where the second generation family member came in to basically be or take over the accounting function. And through a period of about 2 years, was able to write personal checks to herself for about $3 million and just absolutely drains that company. And when you have those conversations between family members, you've got first generation talking to second generation, you're in the middle and you have to say, you know, I'm sorry, but your family member, your child just took $3 million from you. And now we need to shore up internal controls as a result of that. And so it's tragic when you get into those types of situations.
What are the reactions from both the first and the second generation whenever you've had to give that unveiling?
There is first of all, there's anger from the first generation. Yeah. And then it gets into a situation of, well, you know, now the emotions come into play. You're my child. And I don't want to throw the book at you, but I have to throw the book at you. And in the second generation, they can't believe it. How could you do this to me? You know, why would you turn this over to a district attorney for prosecution? I'm your kid.
Wow.
Well, you're $3 million richer and I'm not. The company's broke.
Oh Oh my goodness. That's got to be tough. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, one of the things I love talking about is entrepreneurship, and you are now an entrepreneur, and I got to believe that spending all those years in a large accounting firm, you've seen both big, small, and everything in between. What was it that made you decide to strike out on your own, and kind of talk to the listener a little bit about those early days as an entrepreneur?
I think the main word is passion. For years, while I was doing these annual financial statement audits, I loved the forensic piece. It was different. There were no 2 days that were the same. But any time that I would run into a fraud or an embezzlement, misappropriation, whatever you want to call it, it kind of awakened a passion in me. And so as a result of that, I always had that thought process going that someday this is what I would like to do by myself full time. Focus all my attention on that and not have these other regular audit responsibilities.
Right.
So that's what started that. And I'm finally made the move by realizing that doing a normal audit each year on the same clients year after year after year, if fraud did surface, there was no way for me to actually investigate that because you can't investigate fraud within your own audit client base.
Okay.
Due to advocacy position issues.
Sure.
And so it was limiting right there in those circumstances to where I could not go out and do my own thing. And so I finally bit the bullet and said, this is a passion, number one. Number two, I know the demand is out there. And so I finally did that, finally decided I'm going to do this. I took early retirement from my accounting firm, and I wanted 2 weeks, 2 weeks to advertise or at least tell people a little bit about what I'm doing. And now almost 10 years later, I'm still looking for that 2 week time period to try to let people know. So.
Right. Well, and so and that there's some really cool things to unpack there. It sounds to me like, one of the things that Tony Robbins always says is where focus goes, energy flows. And it looks like you found the lane. I mean, you had this broader range of auditing that you had been, you were astute in, but there was this narrower niche that you were passionate about, and that's where you wanted to put your focus on. And I got to believe that by kind of clearing the decks and focusing on that lane, that's what led to the success that you have now as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. I think that's 100% correct, because my focus, my energies, my passions, as difficult as even with all of the work to do, as difficult it is to start something from scratch, that passion, that focus, that energy is what gets you to the point of being able to be successful.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, like, I've had friends that I did this to some degree. My first company that I ever purchased, I just wanted to be an entrepreneur first. And whether it was a hot dog stand, a broom factory, or whatever, I didn't care. I just wanted to own my own shop. And it was kind of creating this entrepreneur lifestyle. And while it worked, I do think that what I've learned with hindsight being 2020 is what you said. It makes it a lot better if you have something you're truly passionate about, because then even if the cash reserves aren't adding up the way you want to, or your rent's coming due and it's going to be a pinch, at least you're doing what you love on your own, and that's enough to drive you to keep going. It's a much bigger why as to why you've taken that leap. So I think that's very good advice for any would-be entrepreneur.
Absolutely, and it will get you through those times of the lean times, those times where you lay awake at night wondering when the next phone call is going to come. You finish one thing and you look at the schedule and you think, okay, what's going to happen next? And you wait for that phone call. And all through that time, with that energy, with the love of what you're doing, you're able to keep from throwing in the towel.
So one of the things that I like to ask entrepreneurs, especially, I mean, you've got over a decade of experience of it now, because one of the things I'm constantly running into people who think they want to be entrepreneurs, you know, and there's a big difference between wanting to and thinking it's a good idea. I use the analogy all the time that I once thought that it would be a good idea to have a motorcycle until I got on a motorcycle and tried to ride it and realized really quickly that I liked the idea, but the reality of it was horrible. I had no business on the back of a motorcycle, and so I've never been on one again, and I never will be. It's kind of the same thing with, you know, saddling up into entrepreneurship. So if you were to talk to a young, and by the way, I got to mention, you're a Texas Tech Red Raider, like we talked about on the phone the other day. The Red Raiders are very prolific on the Texas Titan podcast. It's you guys are making a very good showing. So guns up good to you, man.
That is good to hear.
So let's say that you've got a recently minted undergrad, MBA, whatever, that comes to you and says, Mr. Dawson, more than anything, I want to own my own business. If you were starting all over again, would you do anything differently? And take us through that planning stage in a little bit more granular detail. You know, how did you prepare for not getting a paycheck, the benefits not coming in? All of a sudden, whenever you're running copies through the copier, you're thinking about how much that ream of paper costs and the lease on the copier, or do you lease or buy a copier? All these little these points of minutia that you have to start all of a sudden thinking about. Take us, like, if you were starting over again, what would you do? Absolutely the same. You wouldn't change a thing because it executed well. Or what would you do differently?
The first thing that I would tell somebody that is just starting out and trying to get into something is recognize the value of the relationships that you may have formed. You know, for years, I went 26 years without doing this. And now 26 years into it, I start my own organization. And I realize those relationships that I made 26 years ago and 20 years ago and 15 years ago, that made the difference. So the first thing that I would tell somebody that's getting ready to start out is let's focus on the relationships, the networking. Never underestimate the value of that. And then as far as not receiving a normal paycheck as an employee, now you're the business owner, there could be situations where you need some good business coaching for somebody to tell you, okay, here are the costs now as an employer. You have to find health insurance. You just mentioned, do you lease or buy a copier? You know, what type of equipment investment can you make to begin? And so all of this needs to be analyzed ahead of time, just in the technology aspect, regardless of what type of business that it is. You know, there is going to be an investment in technology.
Right.
And then, you know, really, I think just having the ability to talk with people, consult with, again, whether it's a business coach or somebody that you just respect that has their own business, ask them those questions. You know, what do I need to consider?
Right. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that I made. There's a couple things. I mean, I made plenty of them, Lord knows. But one of the things that I did not do very well was go seek out other, you know, tenured entrepreneurs that were in small business, even in my industry. That was one of the biggest failures I made, I think, is that I didn't just go to different markets and actually visit with very successful, in my case, real estate brokers to find out, how did you build your firm? How did you scale it? You know, how did you keep your commissions in check? How do you motivate employees? And I think that it took me till I was much older to realize the value of the wisdom of others. You know, I thought it was a sign of weakness. I had to figure it out on my own. That's how I was going to learn it best. And really, there's so much institutional knowledge out there in any given field to go, you know, take from and execute in your own practice. I think that's very smart. Another thing, too, is investing in that coaching. That was another thing. When it's really easy, and you probably have some stories along these lines as well. Early on, when money is tight, you think you can't invest in the one business tool that's always going to be with you, which is you. And I know I tell myself, I can't afford to go to that training. I can't afford to do that. But talk a little bit more about the importance of investing in yourself in those early days. It's not just a cost. I mean, it will yield benefits.
It really will. You know, the just investing in myself, number one, there's, I think, something that people overlook, and this is a self kind of thing, is you better take care of your health. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurship can be a very stressful situation.
Amen.
Again, loss of sleep, long hours, concern, worry, whatever you want to call it. Even successful entrepreneurs, they go through those periods where your health needs to be maintained.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, I believe that, you know, in my profession, keeping up with continuing education, keeping up with the latest in technology and the trends and what's happening out there now, you have to spend money on that education. And so, you know, a business plan. I highly encourage anybody thinking about this, put together a business plan, do a lot of what-if analysis,
right,
and see if you can sustain this. And then not only put together that business plan, but think about monitoring it. You know, right. I think as a society, we're real good at putting a plan together and having it on the shelf, and then we go out and do whatever it is we want to do, and we never go back and look at, well, how do I measure up with the plan that I had established?
Right.
You know, that's an investment that takes time. It's an investment in yourself. And it's one then that if you monitor it properly, you're not going to be in a situation where you wonder where you missed the mark. You'll know early on.
Right, right. Well, and there's something that you touched on that I'm very passionate about, and I'm a firm believer in as well, is the physical fitness aspect and keeping yourself healthy. Because you're right. I mean, it is a mental drain, a physical drain, entrepreneurship, running your own shop. It just, you know, because you'll find yourself having to be the CEO, the company psychologist, the benevolence, you know, officer, all in the course of an afternoon. So what are some of the things now that you're doing to keep yourself mentally sharp? I mean, I love to know what entrepreneurs and leaders read. You know, what are your daily habits? What's a morning routine look like? What are you doing to stay physically fit from a nutritional standpoint, physical standpoint? What are some of those things that you're doing to take care of, again, that most important of business apparatus, which is yourself?
You know, a normal day, I normally get up, it starts at 5:30, and some say maybe that's too early, but at my age, you know, it just gets earlier as you get older.
I'm with you.
I don't even need an alarm clock anymore. My body just wakes up, but get up at 5:30 and go look at, I have a daily project log, and that's the first thing that I consult, just to see, okay, is this really what I'm going to work on today? Because as soon as you make a plan, the phone will ring, and then that plan changes about 10 times during the day.
Right.
But that's a part of it. And then you go through your day, and there are days that I take more breaks than others. But I pretty much, one of the things I want people to understand, if you're doing something you love, if you're doing something that you have the passion about, that you have the focus and the energy, it doesn't seem like work. I know that's cliche. But it doesn't seem like work. And so the day goes pretty quick. And then you get to the end of the day, you've got to make time for yourself and your health. And so whether that's exercise, which I highly recommend, eat right, and then spend time with family. I've got 6 grandkids that they keep me busy. And that's a good thing. They're all local in the same town as I am. And so I learned early on, my first 10 years at the accounting firm, I was a workaholic. And I would work 18, 19, 20 hours a day. And that was as an employee before I became a partner.
Right.
And there's a lot of stress that creates in relationships, and learn it early. You've got to make time for those relationships, for that exercise, for eating right.
Right, Right, right. So, what are some things that you you do? Like, I'm a voracious reader. I'm a slow reader, but I'm trying to. I've actually just launched a newsletter called the Vitruvian Letter, which is kind of how I my motto is improve always in all ways. And the muse for it was Leonardo da Vinci's the Vitruvian Man, which is supposed to be the perfectly proportioned man, which you were just talking about, having to balance, you know, work-life balance, physical, mental. And so, you know, I've just launched this Vitruvian, the first of Vitruvian Challenge, which is to try to get to read one book per week. What are some things that, do you have any favorite books that you've read, either business, fiction, or otherwise, that you'd recommend?
You know, but my favorite books, I always tell people to try to read, and it's been around a pretty good while, but it's Who Moved My Cheese?
Great book. Great book. that's a great one, especially for people that are struggling with change.
Yeah. I mean, it is a business book, and so I'm not much of a fictional reader, and so when I do read, I read things like that, and that was something that, you know, I think benefits – things are going to change, and how do we deal with it? And so that helped me throughout my entire career. And so, you know, I tried, that's one of the better books that I have written or read in a long time. I also try to have a hobby outside of work, something that I can kind of focus on. And that's, I do a lot of hunting, bird hunting. I do a lot of woodworking. Try to keep all my fingers intact, and so
what kind of woodwork? What are you making?
Just fine things like furniture.
Oh, cool.
Shelving, you know, anything basically that the wife needs. You know, I thoroughly enjoy making.
Wow. So okay, now that's interesting. You say that because I got to believe in your line of work. You have a very, very long attention span and an ability to focus and concentrate. Is that something that came naturally to you, or did you have to develop that skill? Because I know for me, that's one of my struggles, and I'm trying, again, with the reading, to be able to focus really intently for longer periods of time. What about you? Is that something that you just kind of came naturally, or did you actually have to make it a discipline?
I would say that came naturally for me. What I have developed over the last several years is a recognition of when I may have gone too long. As I was younger, I would not hit that point. I could go for hours and hours with intense focus, and then at the end of the day, be just as focused as I was at the beginning of the day. Now I've been able to recognize, okay, I'm diminishing returns.
Right.
I need to just stop, take a break, go outside, do whatever's necessary, and then come back and start over. So it was a kind of a natural thing, and it kind of wears down through the years.
Right. Well, let's talk about how that focus, let's get back into to actual forensic accounting. Okay, so there's two things I really want to cover. One, we see that the landscape for work is changing dramatically, where everything is becoming, I guess, digitally centralized, but physically decentralized. So I'd like to know a little bit about, do you see with so much business going online, will this offer better or worse security? And then secondly, just tell the listener out there that is that small business owner or is potentially going to be starting a business soon, what are some tools and systems they can put in place, some checks and balances early on to ensure they don't have that conversation with, you know, that employee of, hey, by the way, we realize what you've been doing and now we've got to face it. You know, kind of take us through some of that.
I'll do that. Let me start that with a story of one of my favorite investigations. And the reason that I'm using this story is because it translates from the pre-digital to the existing digital.
Okay.
And this is not that old of a story, but the way that things were accounted for was a little less digital than they are now. This was an individual that worked for an organization, been with this organization for a long time, and he found a way to cause his company to reimburse him for travel expenses. He found a way to get his company to reimburse him for or pay his credit card companies, Visa and MasterCard, even though he didn't have or the company didn't have a Visa or MasterCard. They just had an American Express. And basically what this person did was he would turn in a monthly expense report with all of the receipts attached. Okay. He would outline, here's what this was for. Here's all the receipts. And he would take those receipts and he would stack them. Some of them were an inch thick. And he would put two pieces of copy paper together, put the receipts in the middle of them, and then staple all around that. And turn this in for reimbursement. Well, thank you for stapling all that together. Now I know, because I trust you as an employee, I don't have to undo all these staples and look at all of these receipts.
Right.
Had they looked at the receipts, they would have seen interesting things such as hotel receipts for 5 to 10 years in the past. Things like that. But my favorite receipt was this guy would go around gas stations. And you know, when you pull up to get gas at a gas station and the previous customer left their receipt dangling in the wind.
Yeah.
He would troll gas stations, and if he saw a pump with a receipt that the previous customer didn't pull off the pump, he would go pull them off the pump. Maybe it's $19.80, and he'd put that in the stack and then staple it all together and that would be it. And he did that to the tune of $1.3 million.
Good night.
As I looked at all of these packages of receipts that had been stapled between two 8.5 by 11 pieces of copy paper, there wasn't one valid piece of paper in there, not one valid receipt. It was all stuff like hotel stays for 5 to 10 years in the past. It was all stuff like ripping the hanging gas station pump receipts and just throwing them in the pile. And so that's an example of how bad it can get. And so I use that to say, you know, one of the best things that a business can do today, because I see so much in the travel expense reimbursement area, is invest in the software, invest in the apps that exist now to take pictures of receipts, to digitally load those receipts, account for travel and expense through an app, and there's a lot of them, so I won't specifically mention one or the other.
Right.
But do your homework and just look at, there's so much that can be done now with software, with apps that provide accounting and documentation and supporting documentation that I highly encourage that.
Right.
Another area is in the area of email, because email is the main form of communication now. There is software available to be able to do textual analytics on email. And even in the smallest of businesses, I encourage you to do some of these analytics, do some keyword searches, and make sure that, you know, monitor on a periodic basis that your workforce, your employees are not out there stealing from you, because it's amazing. They document it in their emails.
Wow. So just a tactical question. If I have construction business, I've got crews out there. Do you recommend company credit card or reimbursement? Which is the safest?
I can ruffle a lot of feathers with this one. That's a great question. I recommend company credit card.
Okay.
With no allowance for personal use, meaning, hey, if you use your company card for personal purposes, you have to reimburse the company.
Okay.
We see a lot of structures like that. And I just say, don't have that reimbursement piece even a part of it. Use the company card for company purposes, and that's it.
Okay. Okay.
I don't like those situations where the employee uses the their personal card for business purposes and then asks the company for reimbursement.
Right.
Okay. There's a lot of abuse, a lot of areas there that opens up for abuse. And so if we just have company credit cards available, that to me, I've seen through the years as the best type of plan.
Okay. What about dual signatures on checks, and who should have signing authority, and what's kind of the sweet spot for, you know, that limit to, okay, you've got up to $1,000 signing authority. Otherwise it needs dual signatures. Kind of what are some of the best practices that you would suggest in that realm?
You know, if we have things are becoming so different because of the ACH payment and things like that. But if we're still dealing with checks, I like single signatures on checks by somebody that does not have reconciliation authority. So if somebody is reconciling the bank account and doing the accounting, they shouldn't have the signature on the checks.
Okay.
Once they shouldn't be the authorized signer. Once that gets over, I'll just say a sweet spot of $5,000 in most small businesses, then at that point in time, dual signatures is something that I like to see.
Okay. What business vertical do you see most susceptible to, say, administrative fraud, or just what are some of those businesses that need to be on high alert for potential fraud? What type of business?
I would say initially, first of all, we find fraud in any type of organization, any type of business on earth. But I would say that financial institutions are particularly susceptible to fraud. And the reason that I say that is because there is a certain amount of cash that exists in a financial institution, be that vault cash or whatever.
Right.
But the thing that makes financial institution fraud so costly is there's also loans. And so if you can get an individual, a relatively high administrative individual that is in charge of the lending function with enough controls, i.e. lack of internal controls, there can be a lot of dispersing of fictitious loans, loans to family members. And so anytime a loan is dispersed at a financial institution, that's money out the door.
Yeah.
So these are big hit type frauds.
Right, right.
We also run into an awful lot of shell company fraud, where an individual that has disbursement authority in an organization basically creates the outside shell company and creates the fictitious invoice and has their company pay their shell company. And those are big dollars and quick dollars.
Yeah, that's one of the things. So a real good friend of mine, I guess my mind just doesn't work this way. Thank goodness. I had no idea that was such a problem with like large construction companies. And one of the things that my very, very dear friend of mine, he has a large construction company. He said that it's not uncommon for two subcontractors to get together and they work change orders. And so, you know, you've got a project supervisor that authorizes a change order to a subcontractor, submits it. There was never, so they'll cut the check for the $2,500 difference on the change order, but there was never any work to be done. So therefore there was never any work done. They just split the $2,500 and go, wow, you know, that was easy.
Absolutely.
And
we see so much of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That in just the construction industry, that's particularly difficult. We had a situation one time where an individual was paying six, the project supervisor set up ACH payments for six different subcontractors, none of which did anything for the organization, nor did he own any of the six subcontractors or have anything to do with them, other than the fact that he had become enemies with the cartels here in Texas.
Oh wow.
And we run into this quite a bit. And the cartel says, okay, we're going to let you live as long as you provide us money. And so in order to live, a motivation for fraud was not to gain personally. It was to continue to live so the cartels wouldn't take him out.
Oh, wow.
So wow. We listen to a lot of that.
Oh my goodness! And I guess that's kind of the same way you would do a, you know, a money laundering operation would kind of be similar to that, right? I mean, it's funny because my wife came to me one day and she said she had heard that someone got in trouble for money laundering. She said, "What in the world is that?" And I was trying to describe that to her, and essentially, that would be kind of the same case on that deal, especially if you had, a principal in the organization who was bringing in cash illegally and just needed to go out somehow and kind of get dispersed, right? I guess.
Right.
And have you now? Let me ask you that. I've got to believe that. I mean, you saw that case. What is that like if you've got a principal, your client, where you find out that they're a crook, that they're actually either laundering or they've set up these shell companies? I mean, can you give us a story where that's happened and kind of what that looked like and how that ended?
Yeah, one of the bigger dollar amounts that we ran into, I won't necessarily talk about that specific dollar amount, but it was that exact type of situation that you're describing there, where we're doing an investigation and we're going down a road of following the predication or the probable cause. And as we go down that road, it points back up to the principal of the organization. And at that point, you know, you have to approach them and say, you know, here's what we've got and here's what this looks like.
Right.
And it gets pretty ugly at that point. You don't want to go outside and mow your lawn just a whole lot or without looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
In this situation, we went ahead and turned it in to the authorities, our report to the authorities, and that individual ended up being prosecuted and actually serving prison time.
Oh, my.
But it's taken from your own company, and it's amazing.
Well, and so in a case like that, does the guy just think that, I mean, does he think you're not as good at your job as you actually are? I mean, he or she hired you. They know what you do for a living. And so there's one or two outcomes. Either one, he goes, well, I'll always hire Steve because he's not very good. I'm going to keep getting away with this. Or, oh, crap, I hope Steve's not as good as what I'm paying him to be, because otherwise he's going to find out. I mean, how does that – what is the thought process?
That's a great question. The thought process is it's a smokescreen gamble is what I call it. They may hire us to come in there and do an internal control consultation.
Yeah.
And that is, hey, come in and look at our internal controls. This isn't even a fraud investigation. It's just an internal control consultation. Come on in and look things over and tell us where the holes are so we can plug them. And as we're going through that process, they know where the holes are, right? Because they're one of the biggest holes.
Right. Right.
And they're just hoping that by going through that process, you are exhibiting to those that care, maybe the investors and the board, that you're taking the steps necessary to make sure that the organization is protected, so to speak.
Right.
With really a gamble of thinking, well, if he finds out what I'm doing, this is all going to come apart. But if he doesn't, then I look good because I just took the gamble to have an internal control consult, pay for that, and now management thinks or owners think that I'm on the ball.
Right. So have you ever been pressured to, hey, look the other way? Don't, because I mean, we know the big stories of like Enron and the pressure that was put on, you know, Arthur Andersen and those firms. I mean, I got to believe somebody said, hey, Steve, you know, if you just kind of look the other way, we'd sure appreciate that. And then that comes into, you know, again, being an entrepreneur that's going to be around for a long time, you got to have that integrity.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about those moments.
That was more, I had more of those types of situations in the normal audit scenario when I was doing regular financial statement audits.
Right.
And not necessarily forensic investigations. If there was a problem in the organization or big adjustments that were needed, then what can we do as far as maybe making sure it's not that big of a deal?
Right.
And you have to stay with your integrity, as you say. in the forensic arena, we don't run into that a whole lot because we're already there investigating what we call predication or probable cause. There's a smoking gun, and no amount of negotiation is going to make the smoke from that gun any less.
Yeah.
And so I don't run into that a whole lot in my arena.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, whenever it's so, tell me about who is going to call you. I mean, what are the main things? Because it's also, I mean, I got to believe too, it's just, you know, I would imagine you're probably part of due diligence on acquisitions, I would think, you know, to, you know, I'm about to go make a $10 million acquisition. Steve, I need you to go look through these books and make sure that I'm getting what I'm paying for. What are some instances in which, you know, I'm going to call your firm to handle some of the forensic accounting, either not just from the nefarious acts that I might suspect is happening in my organization, but also cases like that where I'm making an acquisition or a merger's happening and we want to make sure that there's nothing ugly, you know, kind of under the hood that we can't see.
Right. Basically, we'll get calls, a lot of litigation support. And that's kind of the area that you're talking about there. When we get into litigation support, there is either pre-litigation, something is potentially going to happen, maybe not, depending on my findings. Right. And so it is a due diligence type effort to say, okay, we don't suspect anything. We've got issues that need to be looked at and in a due diligence fashion. And so please come in, look at this, give us your report, and then we'll know things are either clean or potentially not clean. And so a lot in the litigation support arena. We'll get calls, all kinds of different organizations, whether it's a private organization, a public company. We'll get calls from the FBI, the Secret Service, in Texas, the Texas Rangers, as investigative bodies to assist in any type of investigative work that's necessary. We'll get calls from local DAs to investigate something. Police departments, you name it. But that litigation support where people need us to either look at what has happened in a family company records, as an example, a divorce case, or due diligence, what is the supposed value of this organization, all of that is involved in the forensic arena.
Okay. Okay. Now, you bring one up that just kind of prompts a story that I heard, and then I've actually heard this multiple times, where couples get a divorce, and I'm not going to pin it on either the man or the woman. I don't want to get in trouble and get nasty emails, but I'll just say that one spouse who primarily does the grocery shopping will purchase gift cards. And set them aside. It's kind of like a hidden little savings in the instance of retreat. Is that something that you've discovered before? Because when I heard that people were doing that, it just kind of blew my mind. I'm like, you're kidding me. So this individual, they have a household account of however much money per month for groceries, and if they don't spend it all, they basically are buying gift cards and debit cards, like the Visa cash cards, to kind of hoard in the instance of which, first of all, it's no wonder they got a divorce if they're having to make those kind of plans. But I mean, are those things that you see pop up?
Yes. I'm laughing as you're talking about this because we've run into that multiple times.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. And in that exact scenario that you just said, you know, gift cards are a good way to do some little personal private money laundering, so to speak.
Right.
It can change its designation or identification and then later on turn into something else. And so it's a great way to do that or hoard money.
Right.
You know, I've always said, you know, kind of taking this back to a company level, I encourage organizations to look at their office supply credit account. And I'm not picking on anybody, whether it's Office Depot or Staples or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, look at the usage there, because I firmly believe, I jokingly tell this story, but I firmly believe that you can get anything necessary to sustain human life at an Office Depot.
That's about right.
You walk in and first thing you see is food, whether it's candy bars, popcorn, whatever it is up there at the checkout counter. You go a little bit further in there and you'll find water because every office needs water and a big flask of water. And then you'll go through, now you've got two things. You've got food and water. You would need the paper goods, paper plates, and so forth to consume those that food and water. And so you can go find that. And then the last thing that you need to sustain human life is toilet paper. And an Office Depot will have plenty of that, too. And so everything necessary to sustain human life exists in an Office Depot. But the thing that I encourage the review of that Office Depot account for is you can get a gift card for anything that you could possibly need at an Office Depot, at a Staples. Anything like that. And so you just have organizations that there's, it seems like are more susceptible to the selling of gift cards. And we've seen more abuse in that area because it's the least looked at disbursement in most companies. Why is that? Because everybody needs office supplies. There's my Office Depot invoice. I'm not even going to look at that. I'm just going to approve it and go on because it's office supplies.
Right.
Even though 90% of it is gift card purchases. So.
It blows my mind. And, you know, you see these people, again, it goes back to what I said earlier. You know, if they would just apply their minds to something, you know, more beneficial, more productive, you know. And then, and the crazy thing is, I remember there was this this movie I watched. It was called The Family Man. It's a Christmas movie with Nicolas Cage. You seen that one?
Yeah.
And you remember the scene where he meets Don Cheadle's character, and he's playing the clerk, and he gives the girl $5 extra change on purpose, and you can tell by the look on her face, she realizes she got the $5 too much, and she walks out, and he just kind of shakes his head, and he goes, Your entire character over $5. Wow.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what must be amazing for some of the things that you uncover is, you know, you've sullied your reputation, cost you your job, your livelihood over maybe a few $100. I mean, now the girl booking the conferences and making $12,000 a week, still not worth the effort, of course, because you know, it's theft, but
yeah.
But these things that people do just for such small matters, it's really crazy.
It is. It's one of the most frustrating things when I think about society and human behavior that I run into is to see the dollar amounts, whether they're big or little. At what price are we willing to give up our reputation, our career, our ability to earn a livelihood?
Yeah.
And I've never seen a dollar amount that makes it worth that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do confession seeking interviews of suspects all the time. And so these can take a long time where I present one piece of evidence at a time until you wear them down to the point where they say, okay, I can't deny this any longer. I see you've got a stack, you know, 8 inches thick of documentation. So, you know, maybe 8 hours later, I get the confession. And that's the way most of those go. But I had one time where I arranged for the confession seeking interview. And it was about a 65-year-old lady. And she had obviously taken a lot. And I thought, okay, this is going to be tough because she's the grandmotherly type person. And so she walks into the room. I'm expecting a good 8 hours of time. And she walks into the room. I stand up to introduce myself and hold out my hand to shake her hand. And she just puts her hands up and says, that's it. I confess to everything. Everything that you did, I did. Everything that you found, I did. I stole it all. She said, and the reason I'm telling you this now is just to save time, because what I found out is my grandkids know, and I have destroyed their their view of me. So if I can do anything right by confessing to all of this now and maybe get back into positive views in the eyes of the grandkids, then I'm ready to do that. And wow. So reputation, dollar amount, the way that I see, I haven't had one perpetrator tell me in my post-confession interviews that, you know, Steve, it was worth it. It was worth all of the money. It was worth all the stuff I got. Hadn't had one person yet tell me that it was worth it.
Wow. Yeah.
Regardless of me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And just thinking about those sleepless nights, you know, that it caused. And that's probably what all comes to, I got to think all that just kind of comes crashing down, you know, and I've got a funny story. So my great granddad was like, I mean, just a straight as, you know, squeaky clean, straight as an arrow entrepreneur, born in 1900, came from absolutely nothing. And, he became a Chevrolet dealer and owned land and cattle and did other things and just a successful entrepreneur. And I guess it was somewhere around the war, World War II, he had done a lot of cash business. And he had basically, you know, compiled a pretty good cash hoard. And the first night to go file his taxes, he took everything to his CPA, and it was a significant amount of money that he did not claim that first trip. The next day, he went to his CPA and he accounted for every single penny that he didn't report the day before. And my grandmother, when she tells the story, she said, you know, I'm sure my CPA thought that I was crazy because it was, he could have told, I mean, let me think about it. I mean, we're talking the 1940s at that time. It was probably, you know, pretty even easier then. He said, I know my CPA probably thought I was a nut, but man, I sure did sleep good that night.
Yeah.
You know? And there's just, you know, how do you put a price tag on a good night's sleep, right?
So. You can't. I don't think you can. You know, we've had you talk about using these quote, evil talents for good.
Yeah.
If we could just get them to point to the good and use their abilities and their brain to do good things. I have seen circumstances where the fraudster, the person committing the fraud, spends 7 hours a day putting together the Excel spreadsheets tracking what they've taken. And these are elaborate spreadsheets, formulas, everything else in the world in there. And you just think, and I show it to them and I say, why couldn't you use the talents you have here for good,
right?
Rather than tracking your theft all day long. So
yeah,
it's very frustrating. And I don't know how a person like that sleeps.
I don't either. Well, Steve, this has been fun. It's exactly what I thought it would, man. Not just to get to visit with a successful entrepreneur, but also one that's got some cool stories and does something. It has a niche that's a little different than what you hear it every day. So,
well, I hope so.
I really, really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, look, maybe we'll have to get you back on here sometime to talk about some more cases. Or what I'd like to do is possibly we find a business owner that may be in a situation and get you on here and kind of hash through a real case. But before we go, I want to extend you the courtesy, since you've been so generous with your time, to let this audience know where they can find you and, you know, the kind of your ideal client. Take it.
Well, I appreciate that very much. You can find us at the Dawson Forensic Group, and it's DawsonForensicGroup.com. Okay. My email is steve@DawsonForensics.com. And we encourage people to call before the fraud happens. You know, we take part in prevention as much as anything, and we enjoy doing that. So if somebody, an organization needs internal control consult, that's the type of thing we love to do, because we're coming in before the fact rather than after something has been suspected or even discovered to investigate it. And so that type of call we appreciate. We thoroughly enjoy doing it.
Well, great. Steve, congratulations on now not only being a Texas Tech Red Raider, but also a Texas Titan, brother.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Well, that's a wrap on another episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Thank you so much for being here. This has been a Texas Titans media production. If you will, please take the time to go out to iTunes and give us that ever-coveted 5-star rating. It would mean the world to me. Plus, go to jasonrightnow.com, sign up for the Vitruvian Letter, and most importantly, have an incredible rest of your day and week. Thanks for being here.